Your pets rely on you a lot to make sure that they have what they need to be happy and healthy. And when it comes to medications, it's important that they get the right medication at the right time and in the correct dosage. Obviously, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time every month to spend with us and give us advice on keeping our pets healthy and happy. And today she's going to share some important information about making sure your pets get the right medication and what to do if you make a mistake, which hopefully won't happen, Dr. Sandy.
I hope not. Yeah. A couple of things that come to mind are that that we have a huge increase now in veterinary pharmaceuticals being sold through human pharmacies. And one of the issues that a lot of veterinarians are concerned about are the pharmacists that are used to treating humans going to be aware that this is a cat and cats need certain doses or, mm-hmm. Or dogs need certain doses. And so it, we're always concerned about that. And so if you are going to be getting a prescription filled, make sure that it is filled exactly to your veterinarian's recommendations and that you use it as such. You know, I've also seen people that share medications between pets, and there's some things like heartworm preventatives and flea and tick control that are very weight specific. And so you have to be careful that you are giving it at the appropriate dose at the right interval. And when you're using something once a month, sometimes that can be hard to remember unless you link it to a certain day. I know I'm just as bad as the next person. So, having little reminders for yourself. They even make little apps for your cell phone now that give you a monthly reminder to remind you for, doing your pets. But the one thing that I really wanted to bring up is the fact that cats are not small dogs. And using dog medication in your cat could potentially be a problem. And I'm not even talking about prescription medications. I'm talking about things that are available over the counter. We're heading right now, believe it or not, into tick season. And so many people are applying flea and tick preparations to their pet. And there are some, especially products that contain a chemical called a permethrin, which is a synthetic version of a pyrethrin, which is from the chrysanthemum and is very safe but not very effective. And this can be a very potent drug that's well tolerated by dogs but not by cats. And if you have a dog and a cat even sharing the same household, applying it and then having the cat lay next to the dog before the area is dry or lay in the spot where maybe the dog rolled or whatever, there could be enough transfer that the cat can get quite ill. And, treatment, you have to read the labels on your products. I tell people if you want to use a permethrin-based product, put it on at night, have your dog in a crate, wash the bedding in the crate before you let the dog and cat mingle the next morning. By then, everything should be dry and it should be fine. But they just put on the label, don't use in cats. A little tiny thing, but they don't go through all the specifics. So just be careful. Ask your veterinarian what would be best for a multi-species household.
Yeah. And what happens, or let's say, oh my goodness, I've given the cat, the dog
medication. Yeah. Especially something like a permethrin-based product, bathe them right away. I would be using something that's a real good grease cutter, since they tend to be oily products, like a dishwashing detergent. That would be the best thing you can do. And then even if your cat is asymptomatic, get them to an emergency clinic, because there's a very good possibility that some of that chemical has already got absorbed. They may start to develop neurologic signs, and with early treatment, you can help prevent them from becoming, hypothermic and seizuring and having all the side effects that could happen with that.
Oh, you have some information on a new smartphone app. You mentioned apps earlier, but there's one that can help prevent dog bites?
Yeah. Well, it's, you're not going to hold your phone up to the dog or whatever. But I've actually been on this site, and it's a free app. And then once you reach a certain level for $1.99, you can get, additional things, to play. But what it is, it's a little like avatar dog. And he puts himself in various body postures. And you very carefully have to read the tail, the, you know, how the dog's eyes look, the ear position, all these different things, and decide whether the dog is going to bite, maybe will bite, won't bite. You know, there's all these choices you can make. And I've been a vet for, what, 35 years? Mm-hmm. And I barely passed the test. And I think I'm pretty good at reading dog body language, but I got to go back and redo it again and just start learning a little bit. And I think it's really a fun thing because it is kind of this cartoonish type character that a family sitting down with kids can say, hey, you know, if you ever see, you know, Fido looking like this, this would be a time you do not approach him, because they have presented it in a way that's very easy to understand. And I really think it's one that's worthwhile. And it's, if you just go and plug in dog bite prevention strategy, it'll come up as a free app. And it's
that
fun.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I was talking with Dr. Patricia McConnell the other day, and we got on the subject of dog bites. This is just an aside, but what she learned early on, I mean, all of the pets that she dealt with are all the dogs, pretty much. The reason she was there was because they bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she learned that you could, well, what she would do is if a dog came at her, she'd sit there and she'd say, "Where's your ball? Where's your ball?"
Yeah, yeah.
And she said that would stop a lot of them right in their tracks.
And in fact, that is one of the things that we recommend is changing the dog's kind of motivational state. And so if you've got this dog that maybe has picked up a sock or something and is like growling because it wants this sock so bad, although it sounds like you're rewarding the dog, all you're doing is saying, "Hey, you want a treat?" And when the dog drops the sock, you substitute something better, and eventually they learn that, you know, drop the sock, you will get, you may or may not get something better. But it is one of the very common training methods is to, I call it jawing them up, okay, changing their state. But talking about bite wounds, this is National Veterinary Technician Week. And so I think it is a profession that is so underrated because they're behind the scenes in a lot of the times, but boy, we could not function without all our technical staff. And so just a, you know, big shout out to all the techs that are out there because you really do help us be able to do our job. But it was a study out of Minnesota that looked at 465 certified veterinary technicians. So these are people that have gone through special, usually at least a 2-year program of training and lots of on-the-job training as well. And over a 1-year period of time, 1,827 injuries. Can you believe that?
Out of how many?
465.
Oh, my goodness.
So, if you know, they're getting injured, I mean, some 3 or 4 times a year from the way things look, too. And it's, you know, and I think, you know, we as a profession, that's one of the things we have to do is learn how to read animals and you know, the right restraint, right control, which is why we often don't like to have owners be the one to be holding because we need a professional in that position to be able to help us do our job, too.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Brogan in Eau Claire has a question, so let's go there. Brogan, hi. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah. So thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 7-year-old chocolate lab. And just recently, like end of September, like September 20th, around there, we noticed on his back left hind leg, like some dry skin and like losing hair. But it's not like in like a regular, it's not like a circle or anything like that. It's just kind of from the knee down to the paw.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really, haven't been anywhere new. I mean, he's pretty active. He's out in the woods and stuff, but we just kind of watched it, and it had kind of progressed over the past few weeks to where he started to, like, it was starting to get red and inflamed, and, like, you could feel the heat.
Uh-huh.
And so then we were wondering, you know, what could be causing that, and then if there was any kind of, like, a lot of the times, like, for, like, skin irritation, you know, we know, like, well, oils are good to give them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, you know, putting any kind of, like, oil on the skin, like a like a tea tree oil or a lavender oil. I don't know if essential oils were okay for dogs.
You have to be really careful with using products that would be potentially used on people. Some of them can be quite potent and maybe too strong for a dog's skin. Remember, anything you put on the dog may end up in the dog because dogs can lick. And so we, you know, anytime we're applying things topically, we have to make sure that we put it in a spot that the tongue can't get to. Your dog has a really strange distribution for having skin problems. And the fact that it's warm and inflamed makes me concerned that there may be some underlying either vascular problem there, maybe an infectious etiology. Sometimes we do see some types of skin cancer in dogs that can present with just kind of severe flaking and extreme, it's warm. They're usually warm and they may be painful or itchy. It's called cutaneous lymphoma. And before you start just putting things on your dog, I really think that it would be worthwhile to check this out with your veterinarian to see if they can come up with anything. And it may involve doing some skin scrapings, maybe doing some cytology to see if there is, any secondary infections there or primary infections. And then it may even have to go as far if this is like, because it is such an atypical presentation. Most dogs that have things like allergies and skin infections, you're going to see pustules and scabs, and it's usually on their belly. If it's going to be on their feet, if they have allergies, they're usually licking between their toes, and that can cause problems. But it's one leg. Weird distribution needs to be looked at, and don't be surprised if they think that they may need to biopsy it.
No. Okay. Yeah. Good luck, Brogan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And when you call, Judith Sears Poisson, our wonderful, wonderful producer, will be there to answer your call here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're having a fun time talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about keeping your pet or your pets happy and healthy. So join in at 800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And a Facebook comment from Gina: her father's dog was hit by a car, needs surgery or leg amputation. How successful are operations to repair a badly broken leg, and might he need it amputated anyway?
First of all, we see dogs with leg amputations frequently for various causes, either severe trauma where it's beyond repair, maybe we've got some vascular damage. Cancer is another big reason, where they get bone cancer and the leg has to be removed. And dogs seem to adjust really well, especially if the other leg is viable. Unless they've got hip dysplasia or a bad knee or something else that could be a problem, most of them just, get up and get moving and the pain's gone and they never look back. And it's really fun to see these dogs that, they have there's no social implication of being an amputee at all. So, but in this case, the leg needs to be assessed by a veterinarian who can say whether this would be something to be able to be repaired. It's amazing what they can piece back together, whether it's using plates and screws and wires or external fixation devices where there's pins going through the skin and everything's kind of held together on the outside. But it sometimes comes down to expense as well. If it's going to be a prolonged healing time and the prognosis for this dog ever having a normal gait in that leg may be questionable, then, obviously amputation would be something that should be put out there as a possibility. And, don't think you're doing a dog a disservice if it comes down to financial things as well, because, leg amputation, although it is expensive surgery, it's definitely less, than a major orthopedic thing.
So I've seen many tripods,
yes.
They're often called out there, and they always seem happy, and they tearing around.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Mary in Belleville, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I have three schnauzers, and I absolutely dislike the flea and tick medication, the liquid that you have to put on them. It's messy, and all three of them usually have irritated skin. Mm-hmm. So the other day I was at the veterinarian, and they sent me home with a pamphlet about a chewable drug called NexGard, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering what your opinion is of it and if it's as effective.
Well, I'm glad you did bring this up, because a couple of months ago I did talk about this drug, and I didn't really know that much about it, but I have done a lot more investigating, and there's another related product to NexGard. NexGard is a product that lasts for a month. And it's in a chewable cube that they take once a month. And there's another one by a competing company, and the brand is called Bravecto, and it lasts for 3 months. It's a 3-month oral flea and tick pill that is, again, these are just for dogs, not for cats. They're very similar chemical, although the Bravecto one it's not like it's stronger. It's just a slightly change to the molecule to make it last longer in the dog's body. Obviously, in this case, the fleas and ticks have to feed, but they die very, very quickly. And there is, quick enough that disease transmission for things like Lyme disease and so on is not very likely, since that does take hours to a couple of days of feeding before we start seeing transmission. So it is, I think, a viable option for many people. I would recommend that you start looking at the cost of this. It is going to be a slightly more than what you would do on a monthly basis with a spot on. I know that the Bravecto tablets that are the ones that last for 3 months run approximately about $40, $42 when I've been doing some online searching at some of the online pharmacies. And that is independent on the size of the dog. They don't recommend splitting tablets, and so I'd be recommending that you get the size of the tablet that's appropriate for your pet. But I think it's something that we're going to be carrying and is going to be an option that we will be giving to owners. I think it's a great way to get away from topical things that, if you've got multiple pets, like I talked about earlier, with having cats in the environment, treating your dog orally, you don't have to worry about transfer.
That's a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Mary Ann and Gaze Mills, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
And Sandy. I have a couple of cats that are about 12, 13 years old, who have, for the last couple of years, been licking hair off of their bellies and off of their legs. We've been treating the one cat for, maybe 2 or 3 years unsuccessfully with Frontline and some flea baths. And we recently started him with some Resolution and also some a steroid of some kind,
mm-hmm.
methylprednisolone acetate.
Okay.
That he started growing his hair back about a week or 10 days after he got that steroid shot.
Okay.
But now he's going to be bald.
Yeah. We see a lot of these cats doing this, and there's if you were to just go on Google, there's a group called Veterinary Partners, but if you just Google fur mowing, like mowing your lawn,
okay,
this article will come up, and it's a 2-page article that kind of explains our train of thought when we're dealing with one of these cats that we see them barbering their hair coat. Your veterinarian did the right thing initially, getting these cats treated as if it's, because one of the most common causes is what's called flea allergy dermatitis. Cats are really good at grooming fleas off, and even indoor cats can be at risk of getting fleas. People can carry them in on their clothing if you've got wildlife coming through your yard.
Right.
And so you've been doing that appropriately. The fact that you've got two cats and they're kind of older, unless they've had contact with another cat, I don't know if that's possible, but there's another mite that we've been seeing, I don't want to say epidemic proportions, but we've been seeing it a lot more lately, especially coming from shelters and things, and it's called Demodex. It's very different than the dog version of that particular parasite. It is contagious, and it causes cats to itch. And so sometimes what we will do is, rule out flea allergies. Sometimes we'll go through treatment for this particular mite. It's not a lot of fun. We use a product called Lyme Sulfur Dip, and it's weekly dips for 6 weeks to both cats. And so it kind of smells like rotten eggs. Your cats aren't going to see the humor in it. But for many cats, if we're thinking that that's a possibility, obviously we would look for the mites by doing some skin scrapings, looking at a stool sample. I know that sounds weird, but because cats are so good at grooming, we'll often find the mites in the stool as well. So that would be something to think about. Regardless of whether your cat responded to steroids or not, that just decreases the itch. It doesn't tell us what the cause is. And, you know, it still could be some other type of allergy. Food allergies can cause cats to overgroom as well. It would just be odd to have two cats with dietary allergies that are in the same household. But we, you know, going through an elimination diet trial for a good 8 weeks or so, where they go on a hypoallergenic diet that you would get from your veterinarian to see, and they would get nothing else except that diet for that period of time, you may see some improvement. Then you get into allergy testing and going down that path. But the fact that you've got two and they're both doing it, boy, it sounds like something that could be contagious. And I would be, if you're not treating both of them for fleas, definitely do that. And then talk to your veterinarian about going through a Lyme sulfur dip trial.
Yeah. Smelly thing to go through.
You have adopted a cat in the past that had been treated weeks earlier, and I swear for like a good 6 months, because I would see your cat in the clinic, it would be like, oh yeah, oh, to Lyme sulfur.
Oh, I hated it.
Yes. But, yep.
Fortunately, finally, years later, it's gone.
Yeah.
Oh man. We had, it's talking about all these treatments, and there was a nice comment from Daniel, who also posted a great photo of his
lab
dog.
Yeah.
He said, happy and healthy is no accident. Regular checkups, worming, tick treatments and shots, high quality diet, plenty of exercise. Please think carefully before getting a pet. They deserve the best, and it's not cheap or easy.
Preventive medicine is the way to go, and it really is. If you want to save money on vet bills, feed your dog or your cat appropriately, the right amount to keep them lean, to prevent the things that are so easily treatable with heartworm prevention and dewormings and so on. And keeping your dog mentally stimulated, they're not going to be doing things like, eating things in your house that they shouldn't and having GI foreign body surgery. So thank you for that comment. I think, that is like the best advice you can give somebody is practice good preventive care.
Tom in Green Bay, thank you so much for calling. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
We spoke a few months ago regarding pyometra in a 12-year-old lab.
Mm-hmm.
May, four vets told me I had to euthanize her. She recovered and is really healthy. Yesterday, she started heat again. Last spring, the vet said if she survived, I would need to give her antibiotics whenever she goes into heat.
Mm-hmm.
I have cephalexin, but I don't know the dosage.
Yeah, and I'm not going to give it to you because that may not be the appropriate antibiotic to use, because typically the bug that's going to be in there is going to be an E. coli bug is the most common one. And there are other more, better antibiotics that we could potentially use. And your dog may not need them right now. It's possible that this may be a one and done type thing. Who knows? But I think, rather than, one of the things that you may want to even consider, even though she's 12, is having her uterus and ovaries removed to prevent a problem from coming up again. Because we rarely see, just treating with antibiotics, a dog surviving a pyometra. It's difficult to get the antibiotics to penetrate into that thick material that's in there. And so the fact that your dog did survive, you are very lucky. The fact that it's going to maybe happen again, I don't know. I mean, I think I would be strongly pushing getting her in for an ovariohysterectomy and not have to worry about it again.
And what is it again, the pyometra?
A pyometra just means a pus-filled uterus. It's a uterine infection that dogs get. When they come into heat, the uterus, first of all, has a lot of glandular tissue. When they come into heat, the cervix opens up, and sometimes we'll get some material flushing up in there. It's the perfect environment for these bugs to grow. And of course, this is not something you're going to see in real young dogs. It's usually dogs that are older, middle-aged to older, that can run into troubles with this because of, you know, having recurrent heat cycles that changes the structure of their lining of their uterus.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Tom, for calling. I appreciate it. Good luck to you. Donald in Muskego, it's your turn. Hi.
Good morning. Larry, it's good to talk to you on the phone. It's a little bit different than listening on the radio.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to have you on, Don. What's on your mind?
Well, Sandy, good morning to you, too. I have a friend who has a small dog. I believe the dog is a Shih Tzu. And the dog is going to become 8 years old in February. Now, the problem is this dog loves to get up in the middle of the night. And I don't know why it is that it's always in the middle of the night. But he wants to go out and eat green grass. I know that this has happened before because I've had it happen, not at that time of the night, with my own dogs.
Yeah. You know, dogs eat grass for a number of reasons. Sometimes dogs just like a salad now and then, and I would not think that that would be enough to wake up. I mean, I like salads, but I'm not going to get up in the middle of the night to, you know, go and eat a salad. But, you know, the other reason why dogs will do that is to if they go out and start eating random things like grass is as a purgative, that their stomach's upset for some reason. And I'm just putting two and two together, thinking that this is a middle-aged dog. It's happening at night. They wake up from sleeping and they probably feel nauseated. They want to go out and eat grass. Is that I'm wondering if the dog is having some issues with reflux. We just like with people, you know, we can have, you know, a reflux, except for dogs, often it's bile refluxing up into the stomach. It irritates their stomach wall. They get kind of, their tummy gets a little gurgly. They may or may not vomit. But, you know, going out eating grass may help make them feel a little bit better. One of the things that you may want to do besides getting the dog in to make sure that there isn't anything else going on is talking to the veterinarian about getting a dose for something like Pepcid AC or which is a drug called famotidine. You can get generic versions of that as well. Or, you know, Prilosec is another one that we use very commonly in dogs. It's available over the counter for people. But this would be a thing where you'd need to talk to the veterinarian and get the appropriate dose. That would be my first thought. And I don't know, but I would love to know if that helps. And so if it does, call back and let us know.
Yes, for sure.
All right.
Thanks, Donald, for calling, and please do call back next month and let us know.
You know, and some of these dogs, too, just feeding them something before bed, giving them something like a couple of dog biscuits or a handful of their kibble, just gives them something to be in their tummy for a little bit, too, and that may be something else that they could do before they start going and seeing the veterinarian.
Hmm. Jim in Colfax, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Ah, good morning. I sure learned so much every time I listen to you guys. Dr. Sandy, you recommended this spring for the tick collar that normally you said you don't stand behind the tick collars, but this one you do stand behind. After purchasing it, I absolutely 100% stand behind it too.
Awesome.
We used one dose of the Frontline in the spring, and when I had told my wife about it, she went and purchased that online and...
Good.
Is it the Bayer?
It's the Bayer company, and it's called the Seresto collar. Seresto, S-E-R-S-T-O? Seresto, okay, E-S-T-O. Yeah, it lasts for 8 months unless the dog is doing a lot of swimming, and then the efficacy can drop down to about 5 months. But it's safe for use on cats as well. Obviously, they make cat-sized collars, but you can use it in a multi-species household. It's very safe even if children were to grab it. There's so little chemical released with touch. It's based on friction with the dog wearing it all the time. So it's I think they're wonderful, and we've had really good success with people that are in heavy tick areas having the ticks you know, not be an issue for them when that collar's in use.
Well, I just, like I said, I'm backing it up 100%. My dog is with me out in the woods. He's just a little guy. I got a little miniature schnauzer, but he's outside all the time. Ticks. He has, you know, four cats that he plays with in the house. We don't use it on the cats, but there's very few ticks on Vic that the cats bring in. But the dog itself, and with our 3-year-old child, we never felt safer with it.
Good.
And one other compliment is, you're right, taking your dog to the vet. I'm, you know, it's kind of like a human. I don't go unless I'm sick. Well, my wife, after 5 years, took care of a rescue dog. She's adamant about the dog going to the vet once a year, everything on it, a healthy diet, morning and night, on schedule. And I've never had better animals in my life after.
Well, yeah. Thank you for that. And, you know, like I said, preventive care is the way to save money. So yeah,
absolutely. Jim, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. And I just haven't given the number in a long time. Let me do that right now. We have open lines to get you on pretty quickly. Here's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Do you have an issue with your cat or your dog, or just a general question about the health of pets? 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. I had an email from Genevieve. Our tap water in Madison is very hard, so I give my cat Brita filtered water. Does that kind of filter get rid of enough minerals to be safe for her?
You know, I'd have to question why she's concerned about the mineral content in water. I think it is not going to probably be any of any health significance, but it's perfectly safe to use filtered water if you want to do that. There are some conditions where we have to be conscious of the mineral content in foods, in particular some of the urinary tract issues that cats may have with bladder stones. We have to be careful with calcium and magnesium and so on. But there's so little in the water that I really don't think it's probably going to be a huge deal.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today here on the Ideas Network. Somebody asked about tear stains, especially some of the light-colored pets can get those tear stains near their eyes.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this up, because it is an issue for a lot of people with pets that have, especially the short-nosed pets like, you know, some of the Maltese and Shih Tzus and Bulldogs and so on. First of all, the tearing, that staining is pretty normal. When tears contain a chemical called porphyrins, that when they react with light, they will turn that kind of rusty brown color. And so the number one thing is finding out, well, why is my dog tearing excessively to cause that much staining? And it may be that the dog's grooming needs may need to be changed, where the face is kept more clean shaven. It may mean that you have to look for underlying eye problems or eyelid disease that could be causing the dog to tear more. But just reaching for some of the over-the-counter products that are out there that claim to be able to take care of tears can be problematic. In fact, the FDA is starting to crack down on some of these products. There's a number of them on the market that are like a powder that you put in the pet's food. It goes by the name of Angel Eyes, Angel's Glow, Pet Spark, and so on. There's a number of them out there that contain an antibiotic called Tylosin Tartrate, and this is not one that has actually been approved for use in dogs or cats, and it's using an antibiotic for a relatively cosmetic condition. And so, you know, is that an appropriate use for antibiotics, and shouldn't it be something that be put in the veterinarian's hand rather than being an over-the-counter product? So these products are probably not going to be available much longer once the FDA gets a hold of them. Some of the ways that I've dealt with it is primarily just daily cleaning of the face. And there are some very safe products that you can use. There's one that I particularly like called Eye Envy, which is a little cleaning pads that you can use to clean the face. And there's a powder that you can put on that helps keep the area dry. And that seems to really work, but it's a lot of manpower. It's something you have to do on a daily basis.
Oh,
yeah,
that's a lot. That's a lot to do. Tracy in Waupun, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have like a 9-year-old boxer, and he keeps getting all these tumors in his mouth, and I've had him taken off several times, and now I've looked the other day again, and he's got like 4 of them in his mouth.
What kind of tumors are they?
They look like you know, pinkish like skin, and they're real long and dangle along the top of his gum. One runs along the whole top of his gum, but if you put your finger in there, you can pull it down and it will hang out of his mouth.
Okay. Have they,
a lot of them are around his teeth too, you know.
Yeah, have you had them biopsied when they've been taken off?
I did, and they said they weren't cancer.
Okay. A couple of things come to mind. The ones that are around the lips, it may just be skin tags that happen to be occurring there, which can be a problem because the dog could bite them and so on if they're dangly enough. We do see warts in dogs. The papillomavirus is something that is fairly common in dogs. We usually see it in young dogs, not 8-year-old dogs, but it can cause, if you look at a picture of a sea anemone, that is kind of what these warts look like. They have little kind of fingers of tissue coming out. They're usually pink, and their dog may have several of them in the mouth. They're usually self-limiting. Once the dog gets it and develops a good immune response, they typically go away. We may see them on the gum tissue by the teeth, but one thing that boxers tend to be more prone to is what's called gingival hyperplasia, which just means the gums get kind of thicker and more exuberant around the teeth. I don't know if that's what's going on. We can also see these benign tumors that arise from the ligament that holds the tooth in place. And my own dog had this, and she had quite a large mass that we just resected, got it back to what looked like normal tissue, had it looked at, and you know, it's one of these benign masses, but the only way to actually get rid of it is to actually remove that ligament that holds the tooth, which means removing the tooth and part of the bone in the jaw to have it gone. So after 2 debulkings, the third time I said, fine, we're going to take some of the bone away and she's going to lose her lower canine tooth because it was interfering with her ability to play and eat. So that may be what's going on, that they keep coming back because you're not getting to the actual point of what it is. Have your veterinarian actually consult with a veterinary oral surgeon. There's several in the state. We've got a group of them at the veterinary school, and you may find that that would be a good place to start to have this looked into.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because his breath is so bad, you can't stand it.
Yeah, and sometimes when we do have this gum disease going on, because of the deep pockets, you can have issues with bacteria and things building up in there. And so, you know, if your veterinarian is not equipped to be able to do, you know, gum resections and so on, then this may be the time to go and see a veterinary specialist and have that taken care of.
Yeah. Good luck, Tracy.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And we're going to get to Sarah in Campbellsport next. But just to remind you, our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Sandy, we were talking about tear staining earlier, and I know there was something else that you wanted to add.
Yeah, it just one of those things that slipped my mind. There's a product that the Iams company makes that is called Prostora. It's a probiotic that is typically used to re-inoculate the gut with healthy bacteria when you have a pet with diarrhea or maybe they've been parasitized. And as an aside, they happen to find that dogs that were put on this particular very safe, it's a chewable tablet, had very good effect on getting rid of tear staining. We really don't know the method behind it, but it's something that you may want to consider. Obviously, this is not an antibiotic. It's called a probiotic, which just means that it's re-inoculating your gut with healthy bacteria, kind of like what you know you see with the different yogurts and things that are out there for people, although this is more specific for dogs. So might be something else to be looking into if you've got a pet with tear staining and you've been using some of these other old oral products and you're really happy with them, but they're being pulled off the market. Talk to your veterinarian about getting Prostora.
Sarah in Campbellsport, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi. We have a German Shepherd puppy. He's about a year and a half old, and every time it rains, he picks up an ear infection. I'm wondering if there's anything we can do to prevent that other than keep him in the house.
That's unbelievable. Every time it rains, he gets an ear infection. That's very strange.
Every single time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he has erect ears. I'm wondering if he's just getting moisture in there, that there's some, you know, there may, then that may just be triggering it, although we can see dogs swim and never get ear infections, or be bathed all the time and not get ear infections. But so I start wondering, is there some other underlying cause that by adding moisture to that ear environment is just triggering it to develop an infection? And you're actually getting an infection, bacterial yeast infection, or is it just that the ears get red?
No, it's a full-blown infection. He gets the yeast, and then his ears get smelly, and he whines. And
okay.
And
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah, you know, and it's possible that that moisture, if your dog has something like a little bit of inflammation in the ear with the yeast are happily growing there at low levels, you add a little moisture and boom, it just takes off. I'd be looking at why your dog is having this as an issue. And even when the ear is looking normal, I think it would be a good time to go in to your veterinarian, get some ear swabs done, have them look in there with an otoscope to make sure that the ears are healthy, because remember what we see of the ear when we're just visually looking at it is just the top part. It goes down and makes a right-hand turn, and we want to make sure that the eardrums are intact. You'd be surprised how many dogs are walking around with ruptured eardrums with middle ear infections that aren't showing any other symptoms. So that would be the way I would go and see if you can, you know, get to the bottom of this. It may be that we've got an ear mite infection. It may be that your dog has some underlying allergic disease that may need to be addressed, but that's where I would start, is checking when they are apparently looking healthy.
Mm.
Okay.
Good luck, Sarah. Thanks very much for calling. And Kate in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Great.
I have a question with regard to my, I have a 15 and a half year old Jack Russell, so she's been a good dog. She's in declining health. She has very little eyesight and a couple things. In the last 3 weeks, she's really been unable to form like a solid stool. And I don't know if that's just because of her aging process. We haven't changed her food or her diet.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is she's just very confused. And I don't know if it's just because she's kind of lost her sense of smell. You know, so the combination is not good.
Yeah. I just got back from a 2-day intense meeting on gastrointestinal diseases, and boy, talk about everything you want to know about poop. But all I can tell you is that, one, age is not a disease, and a 15-year-old dog should be producing normal stools, especially if you haven't made any diet changes or anything. So there's something else going on there that's causing some imbalance of the, you know, water levels in the fecal material. And so getting a stool sample checked, have your vet look at it. One of the things that they're going to want to try to do is determine, is this a problem with the storage, like down in the colon, or is this a problem up in the digestive end of things with the stomach and small intestines? And that's going to be asking you a bunch of historical questions, and it's going to be things like what the poop looks like. And so I know it sounds gross, but even taking pictures of it, if she does it on the floor or outside, where you can get a good picture of it, that may be very helpful. They're going to want to know, does it look black and tarry? Is there, you know, blood in it? Is there mucus? Is there, is it a large
yellow, yeah, like the yellow bloody mucus. And she also eats regularly, but she's losing weight.
Yeah. Something else is going on in your dog's body. And you know, this would be something that would really require getting her in and having her looked at to figure out, you know, does she have a tumor back in her colon? Does she just have some simple colitis that can be dealt with, and, you know, kind of take things from there depending on what they find. Regarding the fact that she is disoriented, yes, it may be due to her sensory losses, but it's also possible, being a 15-year-old dog, that she has some cognitive decline, or like we call it sometimes doggy Alzheimer's. And that's a very common problem as dogs age. Most dogs that 15 are going to have some symptoms of it, but for some dogs it can be quite profound. They can have changes in their sleep-wake cycle. They may be up wandering at night. They get lost in certain areas of the house that they would normally be able to get around in. They may lose some of their trained behaviors, such as like housebreaking. They don't remember where they're supposed to go. They may have some changes in their social interaction, isolating themselves.
Kind of all all of the above.
Yeah. And again, there are things that can be done to address that. But I think number one, you got to get to the underlying problem with your dog's health. And in the meantime, what I would do is making sure that she's confined to a safe area where she's not going to wander and get into trouble. Leaving nightlights on for her may be helpful, but there are some medications and things that help these dogs with cognitive decline. But I think you've got bigger fish to fry with that, what's going on with her stool.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kitty in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello. Kitty, are you there? We lost Kitty? Well, let's go to Jane in Spring Green then. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I just think I need a little reassurance. I have a 10 or 11-year-old shepherd mix who's been diagnosed with Cushing's, and they did the second test about which kind, and the tumor is on the adrenal gland.
Mm-hmm.
And he's scheduled for surgery the 20th of October, and I would just like to know how good, I mean...
Is your dog symptomatic with the Cushing's disease? Does he... drinking more, thin skin.
Okay. His coat is growing like crazy, and he's put on 8 pounds in 2 months.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
and
yeah.
His breathing is very...
Yeah. Hard. Did they do an abdominal ultrasound?
Yes.
They did. Okay.
Oh, no, not yet. That happens right before the surgery.
Okay. That would be the number one thing that's going to tell you. The adrenal gland sits right on, like if the dog were standing up, like, on his back feet, on top of each of the kidneys. And being a large breed dog, it is definitely more common for the adrenal gland to become overly functional that way with the tumor. With small breed dogs, in more cases than not, is usually some problem with the pituitary gland that tells the adrenal gland to start pumping out more cortisol, which causes all the symptoms, the drinking more, urinating more, pot-bellied, hair loss, big liver, sometimes you can get some other skin changes and so on. There's a lot of dogs that we diagnose with Cushing's disease that they don't even need to be treated. It's like, okay, your dog has Cushing's, but they're asymptomatic, or the symptoms are manageable, we're not even going to do it. But I think getting that ultrasound done, because there are so many big blood vessels there, and sometimes we can see these tumors be quite invasive. I really can't give you an idea of whether the surgery is going to be a success or not until you get that ultrasound report back. And I would make sure that it is done by a really qualified ultrasonographer. I mean, I could probably, in a pinch, sit down with an ultrasound machine and make some pretty pictures, but diagnosing them, it can be really difficult. And so I don't know who's going to be doing the ultrasound, but in something like this, it may be going to surgery or not, make sure your dog's in good hands for that.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Jane. And good luck with your dog. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Phillips, Wisconsin. Another Jane. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My question is this. My dog had canine urchoresis, so we had to switch her to, wet dog food, which we did. But we wanted to keep a little bit of crunchies in there just so that she would have that for her teeth. And we've been giving her Chef Michael's, which is a really good, it's the first ingredient is meat. And what we're finding is after she eats the dry dog food, she stumbles around and acts like she's drunk. She actually loses her footing and falls into walls and everything.
My goodness. What did you say your dog had?
Well, she was like going to the bathroom, little squirts at a time, like for urinating.
Okay.
It's called canine urchoresis or something like that. So anyway, they did have me go to wet dog food. They said that she couldn't handle the dry dog food.
Huh.
I did want to have a little bit of that just for her teeth, but when she eats the Chef Michael's, within probably 15, 20 minutes of eating it, she falls and stumbles.
Yeah. A couple of things that I worry about is, for a dog that is, straining or going out and urinating small amounts, there's a lot. Pardon me?
That's pretty much cured. That was taken care of. She had, the antibiotics, and then we, like I said, we give her mostly the wet dog food, and she has no problem with the urination part anymore.
Yeah.
She hasn't had that for years now.
Okay. Yeah, this it's really strange, and I, you know, I'm worried. Sometimes when we see this very fast reaction to food, there's an issue where the when you're feeding like a high protein food to a dog, the liver is very carefully involved with handling the waste products that are produced by the food going through the, you know, the gastrointestinal tract, and they filter out all the ammonia and other things that can be a problem for the dog if it reaches the brain. And so sometimes when we have dogs with a poor functioning liver or perhaps a what's called a vascular shunt, after they've eaten a high protein meal, they can develop some strange neurologic symptoms where they may head press, they may like walk up to things and push their head up, they may get a little demented, they get wobbly,
right.
And so we can see things like that. And so with you telling me that, I'm not that worried about your dog's urinary system. I'm thinking something's going on with your dog's liver, and that needs to be looked into, and which would mean initially getting some blood work done to look at liver values. They may even, your veterinarian may even want to do a special test called bile acids evaluation, where your dog goes in fasted, a 12-hour fast. We draw a blood sample. We feed your dog. It doesn't even take that much food, a few tablespoons of food. And then we, you know, check a bile acids level a couple hours later to see if the liver was able to get rid of all of that through the body. And so I'm, you know, I think that that would be a route that I would be taking, because that's very strange symptoms that shouldn't happen with just dry food alone.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much, Jane, for calling. I hope you'll take
that
advice.
That sounds pretty serious.
Yeah,
so
that sounds pretty serious. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guest, Dr. Sandy. Stay with us. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She does a great job of keeping up with the latest developments, and she's always willing to share them with you and with me. So I'm always looking forward to her visits. And she comes by once a month, usually the second Tuesday of the month. So in November, should mention, she'll be on November 11th. So that'll be another good day, Sandy.
It will be, yeah.
And we've right now have plenty of work ahead of us here. Lots of fun, actually, with Bill and Madison, I think, up next. Bill, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have about an 8-year-old black lab. My question is, I have a couple of them. She has a growth on right by the side of her butt. And it was smaller to begin with. Now it's developed and gotten bigger and almost turned into like two of them in larger lumps.
Mm-hmm.
She has an appointment to have her teeth cleaned. And at the time, they said they could probably remove that. And I'm wondering if this is a good idea or what it might be.
Yeah, there's a lot of glandular tissue that sits around the anus. And the big problem with diagnosing these bumps is that when we do like a needle biopsy and then send it off, just get some of the cells looked at, it usually comes back as perianal tumor, perianal gland tumor, unable to determine the biologic behavior, meaning whether it's malignant or benign. And so getting them taken off, I think, would be a good idea, especially since they're growing and getting bigger. It's not an area that you can have a lot of tissue removed without potentially getting into the rectal sphincter and causing some incontinence and problems that way. But the big thing is making sure that you do get those biopsied so that we know what we should, you know, what to be looking for down the road. And, you know, whether this would be something that should be done at dentistry or not is a really good, somewhat controversial question. Whenever we're doing dental surgery, even just something as simple as going in, and it may not be that simple, but cleaning the teeth, is we're releasing bacteria into the bloodstream. And so anytime we cut tissues during the time of dentistry, we can start seeding distant areas with bacteria, and it can cause problems with healing. Now, the good news is you're dealing with an area that's already pretty contaminated with bacteria. You're dealing with the rear end. And so, you know, if the veterinarian feels that as a, you know, for time-wise, that your dog isn't going to be under anesthesia for too long, that they can get in and out pretty quickly, then I'd say probably go ahead and do it. But it's going to depend on how long your dog's going to be under for the teeth end of things, too. So,
yeah.
But I think that, it, you know, if it can be managed, I would probably be recommending that both be done at the same time.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Bill. Norman in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon. I wanted to ask Sandy, we have a 9-year-old golden retriever in good health, except for one thing. About the last 2.5 months, he seems to have trouble breathing through his nose, only at night when he's sleeping, and he snores, and he has fluid, especially out of his right nostril, that's clear.
Okay.
And to me, it sounds just like his turbinates are too enlarged, and he can't get his air through. He seems to really labor to breathe.
Oh, my goodness.
His mouth.
Well, I hate to say this, but you say 9-year-old golden, and the first thing that comes to mind is, oh, my goodness, this dog may have a nasal tumor. But I think that it should be up high on the list. We do see nasal cancer in dogs, and it can be fairly, it doesn't have to be fast growing, but because you're dealing with a spot that is, you know, there's no place for that tumor to really go except to plug up the nostrils, you know, that may be what's causing your dog to have these symptoms. But there's also other things like fungal infections that we can see up the nose. Sometimes things like foreign bodies, they get, you know, are out, you know, sniffing around, and they suck something up and get it up in their nose as well. This would be something that I think you need to be talking to your veterinarian about getting some specialty studies done on. I would be recommending that your dog have a CT scan done of its nose. This has to be done under anesthesia, so that you can see, you know, what's involved, the extent of the, you know, damage that may be done in the nose, if there's any other bony changes and things involved. And then after that, going in and doing rhinoscopy, which would mean looking up the nose with a scope, so that perhaps, you know, we can get some tissue samples to be able to determine what it may be, or, you know, and maybe even some cultures if we're thinking that it could be potentially a fungal infection. That would probably be the route you should take, and I'd be making that phone call as soon as you hang up, and I wouldn't be waiting another, you know, few weeks, because something like this can progress. Once it kind of hits a certain stage, and we may start getting nose bleeding and facial deformity and so on. So get your dog in now.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Norman, for calling. And Carol in Oak Creek, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I have a house cat. She's 18 years old. She's always been very petite. She weighs about 6 pounds, normally very healthy. But last year, for the first time, I've always given her vaccinations. But last year, when I got her vaccinations, she had a very bad reaction to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so now this year, I'm afraid to give her vaccinations because, I mean, last year she almost died. I don't know if she's too old for vaccinations anymore.
Well, I can't say that because there's some vaccines that are the law. Do you know what she got vaccinated for?
Yeah, but I was wondering about the other vaccines.
Yeah, well, normally the other vaccines that I would be looking at in an older cat, the rabies vaccine, there's a nice safe one that's designed for cats that's called the PureVax Rabies. The Mary L. Company makes it. They have both a 1-year, and they've come out with a 3-year version of that as well now.
Oh, okay.
A nice safe one to consider using. And so that, you know, depending on whether you got a 1-year rabies or a 3-year rabies, your cat may or may not be due for a rabies vaccine. But it is local ordinance. It's not a state law, but it is local ordinance. And it's because if your cat were to bite somebody, even in self-defense, they would have to go through quarantine for rabies if they weren't current on their vaccines. The thought right now on the other vaccines for cats, the rhinotracheitis, Khaleesi, and panleukopenia, that combo vaccination that we give to cats, is that, you know, cats maintain immunity much longer than we would think. And if that's been something that's been being given annually to your cat, I would recommend that you print off or have a look at the American Association of Feline Practitioners feline vaccine guidelines. They're there for everybody to see. It's written mainly for veterinarians, but it's quite easy to understand. Their recommendations are that that vaccine be given every 3 years, and even that may be overkill. We know that cats will maintain their immunity much longer than that in many cases. It may be 5 or 6 years. It may be 7 years. But the current national guidelines are to do it every 3. I would not be giving your 18-year-old cat a vaccine for something like feline leukemia. It's a young cat disease. The chance of your cat contracting something like that. At this point, I rarely vaccinate cats over a couple of years of age for it unless they're at super high risk, like living in a household with a cat with feline leukemia. I would not be vaccinating your cat for something called chlamydophila or chlamydia. Sometimes that's included in that three-way vaccine, making it a four-way vaccine, and can cause a lot of reactions. It's a treatable disease, and it's one of those generally not recommended vaccines. So without knowing what your cat got, I'd be arming yourself with some information on the current guidelines. And these have been published for a good 15 years, so it's not that new of new information. And your cat may not be due for anything.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. Mary in Vernon County. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to give a heads up to hunters out there because I have a German Shorthair who tangled with a raccoon and ended up with coon paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So basically he was paralyzed for 3 months, and they will come out of it, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of work. And
yeah,
good morning, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what you're describing is something that is we see in the human world. In fact, my sister, when she was young, had the human version of coonhound paralysis. Obviously did not tangle with a raccoon, but it goes in the human world as Guillain-Barré syndrome, and it's a problem where you lose. It's almost like an immune response against the motor nerves as they come off the spine. And, you know, she got to a point where she was hospitalized on a respirator. You'd never know it now. I just saw her last week and, you know, she's fine. She's in her, you know, 50s. But this happened when she was like 4 or 5 years of age. And in people, it's usually associated with being exposed to some type of virus or something. It's one of those like things that you see every day. But why some people react and some don't is a big question. But that would not be my number one reason for, even though you went through 3 months of lots of supportive care with your dog, I'd be more concerned about two other things that raccoons can carry. Actually, three. Number one would be rabies. A lot of raccoons are asymptomatic for rabies. And if your dog does tangle, even if they're current on rabies vaccine, they should get re-inoculated. Even if it was just done 6 months, 8 months, a year ago, get them re-inoculated ASAP because, you know, we want to make sure that we get that a good immunity boosted. The other thing I get worried about is raccoon droppings. They carry a parasite that's called Bayless ascaris. It's a roundworm that is very common in raccoons that can cause very significant disease in people. And sometimes dogs like to roll in raccoon droppings. Sometimes they like to eat them. And sometimes that parasite can be something that can set up housekeeping in your dog. And then, you know, that stool could be really putting you at risk for getting into trouble with that. It's a parasite that likes to leave a path of destruction around the human body, including in the brain. And the other thing is raccoons are probably one of the top carriers of our standard flea. And since they're a nocturnal, if you've got raccoons coming through your yard, you may not even know it, but they are probably between raccoons and possums. It's kind of a toss-up as to which one is the one that carries the most fleas and transmits them to our own pets. So those would be my big things that I'd be worried about.
Mm-hmm. I would, too.
All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Teo in Two Rivers. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. One of my kitties has plasma cell pododermatitis, and I just wanted to know more about it.
Oh, that is very, it's one of those things where it's a biopsy diagnosis, right? You had biopsies done?
Yeah, she's already been diagnosed, and she is under vet care for it, and it's affecting two paws.
Okay, yeah. To be honest with you, I would have to, if this came up in my clinic, I would have to be pulling out textbooks and saying, okay, how do I treat this? I really don't know. I can sit and look at my iPad right now and find out for you. But I'm glad that, it's something, anytime you've got something abnormal, and usually the cats that we've seen with this will have very swollen paw pads. They're painful. I believe that this is a steroid responsive type condition. Whether it's allergic or not, I really don't think so. But I believe that they're often treated with either steroids or some other immune modulating drug like cyclosporine. I may be wrong, but I tell you what, I will be here next month and I'm going to make a big note to look up plasma cell pododermatitis in cats. So, wow. And we'll see if we can figure that out. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Not often that you...
I get stumped, but, I have seen these cases, but they're not that common, but I've got the image in my mind what these cats look like, and I'm like, well, how in the world had I treated that in the past? But, hey, maybe it's my doggy Alzheimer's that's kicking in. Yep.
Dawn in Duluth, your turn. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about sublingual immunotherapy for my golden retriever who has seasonal allergies every fall.
Mm-hmm.
She gets very itchy and she'll end up with secondary infections between her toes and in her ears.
Mm-hmm.
And this year we had the blood test drawn to find out what she's allergic to. And she tested for allergies of almost everything that was on the test, especially things outdoors like grasses and trees and all the common things that we're surrounded by when we go out and have fun.
Uh-huh.
So our vet told us that there's something called sublingual immunotherapy available.
Mm-hmm. And it works.
I'm wondering how effective it is, and do you have experience with it?
We do. And in fact, we just nickname it slit therapy, sublingual immunotherapy. And it's something that was actually developed at the School of Veterinary Medicine here by our dermatology department. It is something that is done on a daily basis rather than with the injectable desensitization shots that we would typically use. So it is something an owner has to be committed to, but it's just a little bit of liquid that in a pump bottle that you just put under the dog's tongue. The big thing with using immune therapy for dealing with allergies is that when you're treating, you're not looking at, solving the dog's problem this year. It may not even get to it next year, but we're looking at kind of it for the dog's future life. It can take several months before you're going to start seeing some benefit. You may not even know until next fall when the allergy season rolls up again. I think the big things to be addressing is if your dog has, it's very clearly cut where it's just seasonal and, 80% of the year your dog does fine, you may be able to manage your dog medically through frequent bathing, using steroid sprays, treating underlying infections, or hopefully heading them off before they happen. And then looking at some of the other drugs that may be able to be used seasonally, like cyclosporine, or a new drug that's in short supply, but hopefully will be back again on the market. It's available, but they just can't keep up with the demand. It's called Apoquil. Very effective drug for dogs with allergic skin disease and with very few side effects, which is nice. Ends up running a little over $1 a day, but it would be something that you could maybe just use seasonally if you need to do that. But, I tend to be looking at the severity of the dog's allergies, how long they last, but definitely if it's something that you want to go with, I'd say give it a try. But just know that it's going to be months before you're going to know.
Right. It does sound like a long-term solution. And her allergies are very predictable. They hit about a week or two before Labor Day and mm-hmm. last through the fall.
Yeah.
And then she's fine the rest of the year.
Yeah. And in those cases, I'd be recommending washing the dog's bedding on a weekly basis, bathing your dog a couple of times a week, damp mopping your dog when they come in from being outside to get rid of external allergens. You know, antihistamines may or may not help. Treating with topical steroid sprays. And then looking into some of these other drugs like Atopica, which is a cyclosporin, or Apoquil, which your vet probably does not have access to. We have, I've had so many people call the vet school looking for this. We only have enough to be able to treat the patients that initially got started, and we are not looking at being able to treat any new patients with it until probably next spring. That's how long it's going to take before we get stocks back up again.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, thanks, Dawn, for calling. I had an email from Tom, who has a dog showing some fleas this fall. She's a mixed breed 50-pounder, 7 years old, had her on Seresto flea and tick collar all summer. I think it's getting near its efficacy limit. I want to switch to Vectra drops, but my question is, should there be a delay between using the Seresto collar and the Vectra drops? I don't want to overdose her. She isn't showing many fleas, but we want to catch it early.
Yeah. I'm really surprised that if your dog has fleas with the Seresto collar on. But the big issue with fleas is the fleas you're seeing on your dog were from eggs that were laid about 2 months earlier. So, you know, if there must have been some break in the treatment, or you've got a external source like raccoons or possums that are hanging around in your yard that are leaving a supply for your dog. And you, seeing the odd flea, your dog isn't totally infested, and you're just seeing the odd one, it may be that your dog's gone out, picked up one, and you're just catching them before they've died. It would be okay to take this Seresto collar off. You don't really need to have a break. And then using Vectra. Vectra is a nice spot-on product. I think the big thing that I like about it is that it's got a cool applicator. But that's about it, okay? So for long-haired dogs, it gets down in there. But is it any better than Advantage or Advantix or some of the other permethrin-based products? Probably not. It is sold only through veterinarians, so you know you're going to be getting a drug that is what's on the label. It's got a large volume. I like Frontline. I like the oral products. I mean, I don't think there's a perfect one for every pet or every owner, but I'd be definitely looking at why is your dog continuing to get fleas if you're using something that is appropriate, and look for an outside source.
We have a 15-year-old cat with extreme dental problems, and it can't take anesthesia. Is there another option for cleaning?
Well, again, I'd have to ask why your cat can't take anesthesia. A lot of elderly pets are very safely anesthetized with careful monitoring, and you really can't clean teeth in an awake state. It's impossible to be able to get in there and get under the gum line, extract teeth that need to be extracted. It's painful. I can barely get cats to open their mouth for me to just look at their teeth, let alone getting in there with equipment and x-ray equipment and so on. So I think that
I guess it almost died the last time.
It did. Oh, okay. Well, if it almost died the last time, looking at those anesthetic records, working with the veterinary anesthesiologist so that they perhaps can come up with a safer protocol that would work better for your cat. And it may be the monitoring or whatever that may have been deficient. But that's where I would be looking, is consulting with one of our veterinary anesthesiologists at the vet school.
Dr. Sandy, it's always a pleasure. As we were saying earlier, you're back in November on November 11th.
I know, yeah.
And you're going to have some new information for us about that one.
Plasma cell pododermatitis, okay? I want everyone to remember that, okay?
Sandy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She'll be back on the 11th of November. Tomorrow at 11, author John Hildebrand shares reflections from his latest book, The Heart of Things, A Midwestern Almanac. And then at 11:45, my good friend Patty Lowe shares some inspiring stories from her book, Seventh Generation Earth Ethics, Native Voices of Wisconsin. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.